Welcome to today's Research to Practice webinar hosted by the Suicide Prevention Resource Center's Training Institute. My name is Laurie Davidson, and I'm manager of SPRC's initiatives related to health and mental health providers. Today's webinar is titled Advancing Suicide Prevention Practice in the Emergency Department Setting. I'll introduce our speakers in just a few moments, but first I'd like to provide a little orientation to the software we're using for this event. Right now, you should be logged into GoToWebinar on a computer, looking at a PowerPoint slide that welcomes you to this webinar. If that's not your experience right now and you need technical assistance, please call SPRC Training Institute staff at area code 307-438-9321. Again, the number to call is 307-438-9321 only if you need technical assistance. If you can hear what I'm saying, then you have already successfully connected to the conference line we are using today. The phone number is on your screen for your colleagues who may need that information. We have several hundred people. I'm looking at 260 right now, and it keeps increasing as we head forward, participating in this event today. So your phone lines will be muted during this entire webinar to eliminate background noise. You can ask questions or make comments at any time during the webinar, though, using the Q&A box on your screen. If you wish to ask a question, simply place your cursor in the box and begin typing. After each presentation, we'll stop to pose a few of your questions to the presenter, and we'll do the same thing at the end of the webinar. We'll do our best to get as many of your questions answered as we can. You may have noticed the list of participants that is on the right-hand side of your screen. Now we're up to 273. More than 600 people had registered to attend this webinar, and they represented the 48 U.S. states, Guam and Puerto Rico, Great Britain, New Zealand, Sweden, and U.S. tribal governments and organizations. We also have people participating from hospital emergency department settings, mental health provider settings. We have public health and suicide prevention professionals, Veterans Administration professionals, trauma and crisis response people, and many others. I'm really glad to see the level of interest in today's webinar topic. Please note that the webinar slides will be available on the SPRC website after the end of the event today. Okay, let's begin. Our speakers today are Glenn Currier, Patricia Alexander, Denise Foster, and Gary Parker. Full bios for our speakers are available on the registration page for the webinar. Dr. Currier will begin. He is Chief of Medical Affairs, Vision 2 Center of Excellence, Canandaigua, New York, VA Medical Center, and Associate Professor in the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Rochester Medical Center. Dr. Currier is a researcher investigating safety planning intervention in 9 VA emergency departments and a services intervention to test the use of mobile crisis teams to link discharged emergency department patients into ongoing ambulatory care, and another project on suicide surveillance in emergency departments at Rochester, the University of Pennsylvania, and Columbia University. Dr. Currier? Stand by, everyone. I'm trying to determine what is happening. Are you still hearing the moderator? Please would someone indicate whether you are still hearing me, Lori? Good. So, Tiffany, people are still hearing me, but are not hearing Dr. Currier. He is on. One moment. We are locating, since we have to unmute Dr. Currier's line, we are searching for the number that he's at, which may sound like a simple thing, but if you've ever been a moderator or a technical person behind a webinar, it can be difficult. So stand by, everyone. We'll be with you in just one moment.
Hello.
Dr. Currier, welcome.
Your robot just told me my microphone was turned on. So sorry for that rocky start, people. My name is Glenn Currier, and I am a physician who works in an emergency room, have done so for the past 12 years, have a lot of interest in acute care of the mentally ill. It's been my observation over this decade or so that in the beginning, no attention was paid to psychiatry in the ED. Over the last 5 to 7 years, we've become aware of the importance of management of psychotic people, violence, restraint, seclusion. But it's only within the last couple of years that suicidal patients, who represent at least half of the players who come to EDs for psych complaints, have gotten really any attention at all. And that's a terrible thing, but I hope we can help rectify that. Our goals today are pretty straightforward. We would like to tell you about several initiatives that are going on in the U.S., both in the VA and in the, quote, civilian healthcare sectors, that hopefully will provide some new tools to stick in your toolkit as you deal with these folks and have some real practical implications. Now, the next step, if someone could advance the slide. Here we go. Perhaps I've been watching too much CNN lately, but every headline has to have an exclamation point and everything has to be put in the most hysterical terms. Unfortunately, there's a bit of truth to this in terms of health service delivery for the mentally ill. These are data that were published about a decade ago, but the trend has only continued since then. And it shows that basically throughout North America and Western Europe in particular, there's been a precipitous and steady decline in the number of resources that are allocated toward care of the mentally ill, as exemplified by the number of inpatient beds here. You can see in this group of 7 countries, in all but one, the number of beds have declined by at least 2/3, whereas Japan is the notable outlier. So we're living in an era where deinstitutionalization is the norm, and unfortunately, emergency departments are really sort of the lightning rod for the aftermath of this, as mentally ill have to get care somewhere. So you could fairly ask the question, how has decreased availability of specialty mental health services played out for patient care? These data are from the same study, and it's fairly tragic. The mortality rate that is attributable to mental illness and substance use disorders per 100,000 population has skyrocketed almost in a linear fashion with the number of decreased beds. The notable outlier in this analysis is Japan, where they did increase beds and the death rate declined. So we're not doing the adequate care of mentally ill, both from a medical and a psychiatric perspective, and EDC the aftermath of that. Suicide, the topic of the day, has not increased, but it has not decreased, as have the other leading causes of death, at least in young people, including motor vehicle accidents and homicide. So the rate is flat, but the population is growing, so that really sort of translates into increased numbers of patients who receive care in ED settings for suicide. Of particular interest to those of us who work in the VA is the impact of this for not only veterans but active duty military personnel. This is a quote from the New York Times in 2007. Unfortunately, the situation has not changed adequately since then. But as you can see, veterans aged 20 through 24 had the highest suicide rates among all veterans. And in January of 2 years ago, actually, the death rate from suicide was higher than that from actual casualties in Iraq. Another fair question is, how has this decreased availability of specialty mental health services played out for the ED, for the people who work in it, and for service designers? Well, it's pretty clear that the number of people coming to EDs has continued to escalate over the years. These are data from 2002 that were published about 6 years ago, most recent stuff out there that I'm aware of. There were 100 million ED visits in 2002 for all causes. That represented a 20% increase in the number of visits over the prior decade. Unfortunately, concurrently with that, 15% of EDs in the United States closed for a variety of financial pressures, hospital mergers and the like. Of the total number of presentations, about 1 out of 20 were for mental health reasons as the primary complaint, although I'll show you data in a little bit to suggest that there's this sort of, that's an iceberg effect. Psych plays, you know, a very big role, and many people who come for a variety of chief complaints. 7% of people were in EDs for suicide attempts, so that translates to about 500,000 visits per year, not including ideators. I think that it's not any mystery to folks who work in these services that often care of the mentally ill can be challenging for a variety of reasons. For people who come to the ED for suicide complaints, mood disorders and substance abuse are the highest, most frequently diagnosed conditions. They also confer the highest suicide risk of the mental disorders. Suicidal presentations are very common, but the range of severity is extensive, from people who are coming in for hotel services to people who are really at the most acute risk imaginable of suicide. We do know that over time, the phenomenon has been to increasingly discharge people directly from the ED, not admit them to beds that no longer exist. And along with that, we've seen a pattern of recidivism known as the frequent flyer phenomenon. Makes it very challenging to work with people in the ED setting. Okay. What has also become increasingly obvious over the last few years is that the burden of suicidality is actually distributed in a surprisingly heavy way toward people who come to the ED for a variety of other complaints not related to mental health at all. This is a study done by Cindy Klassen, a terrific researcher who basically walked around in the medical ED waiting room at Parkland Hospital in Texas and asked about 1,600 people about risk for suicide, and surprisingly, almost 12% were described suicidal ideation at the time of the survey, 2% with definite plans. 4 of the 31 who had plans actually attempted within 45 days of ED presentation. So I think it's fair to say that suicide risk is endemic in all emergency department populations. One of the most troubling aspects of this is that treating suicidal patients in the ED is a very time-consuming venture, and even though as a total number of all ED registrants they are a minority, they tend to stick out like a sore thumb because, you know, as escalating patient acuity places a huge strain on ED resources, people back up. There's a gridlock phenomenon. And the fact that psych beds are even more scarce than general medical surgical beds has made this an area of great concern. How does this translate into the experience of care for people who present to EDs after having made a suicide attempt or their families? This is a study done by a terrific person named Julie Sorrell at University of Kentucky. She used the NAMI website to sort of harvest the experience of consumers and family members who had recently been in the ED for care. Unfortunately, over half of these people described not only receiving not humane care, but actually it made it worse. They were directly punished or stigmatized by staff. Less than half felt that staff actually took a proactive role, listened to them, took their complaints seriously. Majority of folks also describe the experience of unprofessional staff behavior. Clearly, there's room for improvement, at least in some settings. But, you know, aside from the basic desire that we want to render good care to people, what is the impact of this aversive experience at least some people are having in the ED? Well, I would argue that it's at least in your best interest to do the best you can to help people have a good experience with health care, because otherwise they'll be back in your emergency room the next Friday night at 3 a.m., as you've seen them now. We know this is a notoriously difficult group to link into care. Up to half refuse outpatient treatment after referral from the ED. And of those who do link, the majority don't attend one session beyond the first intake. So we want to get people more in a mindset that they will follow through with care. Okay, with that little backstory, I just wanted to talk a bit about the rubric for the research projects that we're about to describe. There are numerous opportunities to improve care of suicidal patients in the ED. We need to improve screening and recognition. We need to improve assessment and risk stratification so that the actions we embark upon are actually grounded in something empirical. We need to improve provider knowledge and attitudes. We need to improve the range of definitive treatment options that are available to do something with the patient while you still have them in the ED itself. We need to improve connection with specialty care after ED discharge, and we need to know better what happens to people after they leave. Okay. So the first project I'd like to tell you about is something we just recently finished, and it was kind of cool because it's so low-tech. We're going to be talking about this project at the AAS meeting in Portland, if anybody is interested. There will be a lot more data presented there, but briefly, this is a poster project that we used in a variety of emergency departments. It's probably the lowest-tech project you've ever seen. It was supported by the SPRC. It was conducted up here in upstate New York, where we have a network of 6 academic and community emergency departments that are set up to do research like this. In a nutshell, providers, including residents, nurses, mid-levels, and attending ED docs, were in 4 emergency rooms, did a pre-post survey that talked in detail about their experiences treating suicidal patients, their viewpoints toward these patients, and in kind of deficits in their knowledge base. Providers in a separate ED did the pre-post survey, but no intervention was done. We measured attitude, a variety of perceived skills, as you see here. Okay, the intervention itself consisted of basically, and I'll show you this in a minute, a poster that was mounted in either the break room or the charting room of each ED. Along with the poster was distributed an accompanying clinical guide that talked in a little bit more detail about how to pose questions and how to approach people around suicide and their risk stratification. The study involved 3 phases. We did a baseline survey, gave them 3 weeks to do that through SurveyMonkey. We hung the poster for a month, and then we took it down and did a post-intervention repeat survey. Okay, I'm going to give you a link in case anybody wants to download this. I think paper copies are also available in a nice 11x17 glossy format. But here's the top half of the poster, signs of acute suicide risk, other factors. Here's the bottom half. It provides a list of questions that might be useful to pose, and it actually is somewhat challenging insofar as it prompts people to ask questions in a non-judgmental, non-condescending, matter-of-fact way, almost implying that maybe this wasn't happening before. This poster was supported by a lot of groups, including the SPRC, the Emergency Nurses Association, American Association of Suicidology, American Association for Emergency Psychiatry, and American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. So it's been distributed widely. You may have seen it already. This is the first half of the guide that goes with it that talks in more detail about some of the more relevant clinical things to ask about. And here is the second half of that guide that talks. It takes practitioners through all steps of the assessment and appropriate means for discharge. Okay, just to give you a taste of the results, by exposed subjects, I mean doctors, nurses, and such who had the poster mounted in the, at their shop and actually remembered seeing it. That's what we're calling exposed subjects. And it was very helpful, surprisingly so, across the board. Doctors and such noted that if in subjects they're worried about, ED providers, quote, always ask them about risk factors for suicide. 58% in the trained group, 41%, or less than half in the untrained group. Providers who remembered the poster also always ask directly if patients they're concerned about are having suicidal thoughts. About 52% of the intervention subjects reported that they suspected underlying or concealed suicidal ideation in a patient who presented without a mental health related chief complaint in the past month, compared to less than 20% or 1 out of 5 of clinicians in the untrained sites. Also, a higher proportion of intervention site subjects, about 3/4 relative to comparator groups, agreed with the statement, the ED where I work has a very good protocol for managing suicidal patients when they are identified. This poster was, in fact, the only protocol in existence in any of these sites. So somehow the leadership of the ED taking the effort to distribute these posters and these guides somehow inferred a kind of interest in the topic that brought up the whole standard of care across the site. So it was a wholly useful thing to do, cost nothing, and the uptake was quite useful. Actually, nobody had any issue with this going on in their EDs, so we were pleased. And think that significant improvements in self-reported practice patterns can be achieved through a very simple intervention of hanging a wall poster and distributing a one-page clinical guide to ED clinicians. There's very little downside in doing this. And if you want copies of things, here are the links by which you can obtain them. Okay, very briefly, because Dr. Alexander is going to talk about this in more detail, I want to talk about a second project called SafeVet that's being done in the emergency department at several EDs around the country with several goals, improving the identification of suicidal veterans in the VA and community EDs, linking suicidal veterans to appropriate VA services, providing a very brief ED-based intervention to reduce risk, and then taking steps to link veterans to follow-up care in the VA. The logic for this is, if you think about it for a minute, if how mentally ill people or suicidal people are handled in the ED, it varies dramatically from almost every other type of condition for which people present. For example, a fracture. When someone comes in with a simple fracture that doesn't require immediate surgery or hospital admission, we diagnose through imaging and such, we treat, we immobilize and stabilize, apply a cast and treat the pain, and then we refer to follow-up. It's a little bit different with suicide because we assess imminent danger, we conduct a risk assessment, we triage, they either go upstairs or go out the door. If discharged, we refer for treatment, but this approach is so different because there's no treatment per se that's rendered in the ED. we don't have the equivalent of a cast available for suicide risk. So one of the major goals of SafeVet is to develop something that is feasible in an ED that ameliorates risks till people can be linked to outpatient care. The tool we use to do that is called safety planning. I know that phrase is bandied around, and there are many people who call different things safety planning. But this in particular tests an intervention developed by Dr. Barbara Stanley from Columbia and Greg Brown from Penn that has been widely distributed throughout the VA. It includes four evidence-based strategies, including means restriction, teaching brief problem-solving and coping skills, enhancing social support, and motivational enhancement to stick with care. The other aspect of this project that is pretty unique is replicating the successful experience of suicide prevention coordinators, which are staff allocated at all 153 VA medical centers and large outpatient services to deal specifically with high-risk suicidal individuals. We developed a position called acute services coordinators who work in EDs who work only not only with high-risk but with moderate-risk suicidal veterans as well. Okay. I think I'm going to let Dr. Alexander, in the interest of time, take you through more of the specifics around safety planning. And at this point, if anybody has any questions, I'd be very happy to answer them.
Thank you, Dr. Currier. I just want to remind everybody that the webinar slides will be available on the SPRC website after the end of the event today. And I believe, actually, they may even be available there right now. And I'm looking at one question that I'm thinking of holding till the end. But now I see some other, and the reason I wanted to do that is to give all the presenters an opportunity to answer that. Let's see. Here's a question: Are the acute services coordinators only in VA hospitals? Are there any at this point? Do you know, Dr. Currier, in community EDs?
VA. Since this is a clinical demonstration project in the VA, funded by VA clinical dollars, it's a model that's unique to the VA. Although part of their goal is to reach out to the community EDs and assist with getting veterans into VA care in their communities,
mm-hmm.
I think this will be very replicable later. But right now, it's unique to the VA.
Yeah, and I think that's part of the reason we wanted to highlight this practice in this webinar today, is so that more community EDs would consider it. Does having a crisis worker in the ED make a difference? Would this be a recommendation that you would make to other EDs?
Well, what we're finding is that it's somewhat dependent on the volumes of patients served. So in larger urban EDs that have a huge psych volume, it's turning out to be clearly useful, and they're busy. You know, you can absolutely fill an FTE with this kind of work. But in smaller, more rural areas, we're looking at ways to do it perhaps through the hotline or in a shared way across EDs because it isn't super cost effective. So it depends on your site and your needs.
Mm-hmm. And then among those in the intervention arm who were exposed to the poster and guide, what proportion remembered the poster and guide?
80%.
That's great.
Yeah, so it was good.
There was one comment about the strength of the study. Is there any evaluation going to be done to further establish the effects of the poster?
Well, these data are out of a manuscript that's under review, so I was somewhat constrained in what I could
say.
But, yeah, I think, God willing, it'll be out there for people to criticize and such and figure out whether it relates to their work. But I would look for that hopefully within the next 6 months.
Great. Let's at this point go ahead and move on, and we'll have another opportunity for additional questions after the end of each speaker and at the very end. And just another reminder that webinar slides will be available or are available on the registration page, actually, for this webinar. Thanks so much, Dr. Currier. Our next speaker is Patricia Alexander, and she is the Mental Illness Research, Education, and Clinical Centers Investigator for the Rocky Mountain region of the Veterans Administration in Denver, Colorado. Dr. Alexander is the Acute Services Coordinator for the Suicide Assessment and Follow-Up Engagement Veteran Emergency Treatment, SAFE-VET, the program that Dr. Curry was just talking about, clinical demonstration project. She's a member of the VISN-19 MIRAC Outpatient Inpatient Suicide Consultation Service and a senior lecturer at the University of Colorado Health Sciences Center. Dr. Alexander is a former active duty Air Force officer with 25 years of clinical and teaching experience in the areas of combat-related stress and post-traumatic stress disorder. Dr. Alexander.
Hey, good morning or good afternoon. It's nice to be with everybody. And I think Dr. Currier gave me a really nice introduction because I am the acute service coordinator for the SAFE-VET Clinical Demonstration Project. What I'm going to do today, there are a lot of slides in this presentation, and I'm going to just quickly go through some of them. But what I want to do is give you a very brief overview of the SAFE-VET project. I've included a copy of the VA's safety plan and how you can use it. But what I really want to talk to you about today is something that I think is getting lost in our training and in our thinking about how to deal with this very difficult population. I mean, it used to be that you could pretty much see anybody and nobody. You could see people, you could do things, you could bill for it, and nobody really challenged what you were doing or why you were doing it. And in the late 80s and early 90s, we had the whole managed care system come into place, which then out of that developed evidence-based treatment protocols, which are outstanding. But one of the things that I'm afraid is getting lost, and what is so critical with suicidal patients, is the role we as clinicians play in that interaction. So I'm going to spend more of my time talking about what we need to bring to that encounter with the suicidal patient to really make a difference. So to start, the typical strategy for crisis intervention is to do whatever risk assessment you're used to doing, and then either hospitalize the person or refer them for treatment, offering usually a limited number of sessions. And some people are still doing a no-suicide contract, which I think most of us learned early on, where we have the patient sign a piece of paper saying they promise not to kill themselves, and we hope they won't kill themselves on our watch, so it gets pretty stressful. But the problem with this kind of strategy is that the people we see probably don't have a way to manage their own stress. We've looked at the numbers from the previous slides. They don't engage in follow-up treatment. If they do, they tend not to go to more than one. And the usual strategy in dealing with these folks is it doesn't really protect the patient, and it certainly doesn't protect the clinician from any kind of legal problems. How do I go back here? Well, the rationale for the SAFE-VET project was looking at moderate risk patients. And again, most of these folks are discharged, even if they're at higher risk. 50 to 90% of those with suicidal ideation refuse treatment or don't show up. And again, they don't go to treatment. And my slide's not moving forward. So the safety planning goals were to assist the patient in managing the crisis in the moment. In a way, it's really more of a way for them to buy time. We always explain that this is not going to solve their problem, but that a suicidal crisis doesn't happen. It doesn't come from out of the blue, even though it seems like it has a life of its own, that there are always things that have happened at any point during the crisis you can make an intervention on your own. You know, a lot of the people we see are military people who are used to always having a plan prior to going into any kind of training, prior to doing anything with the military. So this is not a new concept. And I think this also applies to anyone in the civilian population. people are very often used to making lists and kind of structuring what they're going to do. And so we really call on them to use these overlearned skills and adapt it to their emotional well-being. The other thing we do is we provide regular support by phone or in person until they're engaged in treatment. We review how they're doing. Are they feeling suicidal? What's their mood like? Have they had to use a safety plan? Do they need to make any changes to their safety plan? So they've really got a safety net with us until they're engaged in care. What a safety plan isn't is a no-suicide contract. It really is a written, prioritized list of coping strategies and resources they can use in a crisis. And what it ends up doing is providing them with an increased sense of control. It's all on one page. It's a brief format. And the biggest piece of this, and why I call it a standalone intervention, it involves a collaborative relationship with the patient and the clinician. We don't just hand them the safety plan and say, hey, fill this out and we'll look at it before you leave the ED, or we'll look at it before you leave my office. You really sit down with them and spend a little time to make this something that's useful for them. It's also an evidence-based treatment. So we look at how to restrict access to lethal means. We look at or teach brief problem-solving skills and coping skills. We look at social support, identify emergency contacts, and really use motivational enhancement. Again, it's a standalone intervention. When I first started doing this, I thought, how are we going to use this and teach people in the ED to use it and do it as quickly as possible so it will be used? What I've learned is it's really a very elegant way to engage people in solving their own problems. They can feel more empowered, and they've got something on one page that they can call on when they get into a crisis. So these next two slides are a copy of the VA safety plan. I'm sorry I couldn't get it on one page, but it's six steps, and I usually write it. We always do it as a paper and pencil, and then I hand it to them. Again, I sit right next to them, so it's really a very collaborative effort to do this. And I'm going to quickly run through what the six steps are. Recognizing the warning signs and triggers. How do you distract yourself without having to contact another person? Who could you call or where could you go? Again, just to provide distraction. Just to again, buy you a little time and maybe change your frame of mind. Step four, identifying people who you can ask for help. Identifying professionals or agencies you can contact during a crisis. And then number six is, how do you make the environment safer? As we go through steps two through six, I always ask, what are any barriers or obstacles that would prevent you from using this step? Because oftentimes people will just want to write something down, and then I really go back and say, would you really do this? What would get in your way? Because I want them to leave with something that is really meaningful for them. The next few slides are just a little more step-by-step how you use this safety plan. So recognizing the warning signs, thoughts, feelings, behaviors that can trigger a suicidal crisis. Again, internal coping strategies, what kinds of things can you do on your own? People or social settings. There's a place on the safety plan to include a person's phone number. And a lot of us have people's phone numbers in our cell phones, and we really want them down on the piece of paper and remind them that in a crisis, that prefrontal cortex that allows us to plan and organize pretty much goes offline, and that people even have difficulty dialing 911 when they're in a crisis. So if they don't have the number with them, I'll always call them back to get the number and make sure it's on their plan. Step four, the distractors haven't worked, so now how do you reach out to somebody else? And again, be sure to put the phone numbers on there. We want them to have one page where everything is accessible. And then professional agencies they can contact. And, you know, We have our VA suicide prevention coordinators. We have the crisis line. You can easily adapt this to the civilian population and put local ED services. Step six, making the environment safer. We always ask if they have access to a firearm and what they could do to make it a little more difficult to access, including putting it in a gun safe, having a trigger lock, giving it to someone else. Talk about medications. Is someone else there who can manage the medications for them? Can the medications be placed in a safe? The other thing we're really paying attention to now is the role that drugs and alcohol play prior to a suicide attempt, and looking at restriction of drugs and alcohol as a conduit to lethal means. What I really want to talk about is the role we as clinicians bring to this relationship, and this often gets missed because we do get focused on making sure we've covered all the bases, we've documented well, we've covered ourselves legally. And so I think if there's one takeaway message from my presentation is pay attention to what you're bringing to the relationship, and you bring yourself and your personality into the collaboration. When I go in and talk to someone, I'm not immediately focused on their suicidal thoughts or their suicidal plan. I start looking immediately for how can I connect with this person. And it can get a little tricky sometimes. It may be, you know, you're from the same place or you share the same birth month. Anything you can do to start making that connection will really make a difference and really change the nature of their interaction with you in a time of great crisis. And I weave my questions about their suicidal thoughts or plans into a conversation about their life. It's really important when you're doing this to let them tell their story. And in the midst of them telling them their story, pull out things that are useful for the plan. The most interesting thing is that it doesn't take that much time to make a person feel valued and cared for. And these are skills all of us as clinicians have been using with our patients. There's so much anxiety and often fear about dealing with a suicidal patient that we tend to focus more on the suicidal ideation, which is a critical piece. But we really need to develop that relationship because it's always about the relationship, and that is what's going to make the difference. So I'd say be familiar enough with the safety planning steps that you don't sound like you're going through it by rote. You have a conversation with the patient as you develop the plan. Help them recognize the strengths and skills that they have outside of the crisis and help them apply those. And draw on their history to support the positive side of their ambivalence, because when a person's suicidal, they're always ambivalent, and we want to play to the positive side. What you need to bring to the relationship is general understanding about suicide and suicidal crisis, and we need to bring hope into the relationship. This slide I didn't really give you the correct source. It's actually from David Jobe's book on managing suicidal risk, A Collaborative Approach, and then he quoted the other sources. But the greatest thing that we can bring to these people we see is a sense of hope. No single construct has been more highly correlated with completed suicide than hopelessness. And I think sometimes we underestimate what we can bring to the encounter with them. So how do we bring hope? Learn as much about suicide as we can. The website that you're on right now, the Suicide Prevention Resource Center, has excellent links to their resources, to their online library. Be sure to be very familiar with warning signs, risks, and protective factors, but don't limit yourself to that. Really trust your limbic tunes, and that is the gut feeling. I wish I'd coined that term, limbic tunes, but it actually comes from the Massachusetts General Consult Service, and it's just so good, and sometimes we ignore that when we're dealing with these high-risk folks. Most of these people have some kind of psychiatric diagnosis, and that's what we're most skilled at. So bring your clinical training and experience to help them create options. two big things we've noticed, especially here in the MIRIC where we deal with suicide every day. There's something very powerful about being able to talk to someone very openly and directly about suicide. And I think on the previous slide that I skipped over, one of the things I said was you have to be the alpha in the room, and that is you have to be the one who really kind of holds the control and the power for them right now in this very vulnerable state. So, again, understand and have compassion for the role that suicidal thoughts are playing in the person's life, and just be there for them. So I'm in the essence of time, I'm going to stop right now, but really thank you for being on this webinar.
Thank you very much, Dr. Alexander. We do have a couple of questions, and I just want to note for the audience that instead of raising your hands, what you'll need to do is type your questions into the Q&A box. We are not unmuting phone lines to allow people to ask their questions, given that there are nearly 400 participants on this webinar. So a couple of questions. Does the safety planning involve family members that also may be present in the ER at the time of the crisis?
You know, if it seems appropriate to include the family member, I absolutely would. Again, we're trying to build a relationship with these people. I just go back to my main take-home message. It's always about the relationship. So if the family members are providing positive support, absolutely bring them in.
Mm-hmm. And another one, is it important to limit the coping strategies to only 3 items?
No.
What if the client lists more triggers?
No, that's all we had space for on that safety plan, and I would say put as many down as you can. And, you know, the other thing is that this is not, this is an evolving plan, and it can be modified and changed as the person kind of, as the crisis kind of smooths out and they're able to access more coping strategies. So as many options as they can have on the plan, the better it is.
So this is an interesting sort of more general question about suicide prevention. From a clinician who is soon to graduate about what students have been told about suicidal clients is to validate their concerns and pains, but that hope was often something that was left out. And the questioner says he had a gut instinct that this was still useful. What are your thoughts?
That instilling hope is useful?
Yes.
I think instilling hope is one of the most critical pieces. And we can do that, again, by, you know, suicidal patients engender a lot of fears and anxiety in us as clinicians. We don't want somebody to die on our watch. And the more we can know about suicide, the more comfortable we can be with our ability to relate to the person, recognize the warning signs and the protective factors and the risk factors, but really trying to engage them. Often this could be a one-shot deal. And Dr. Currier talked about people's negative experiences in the emergency rooms. We can be that positive experience. And by doing that, we can instill hope, which I just think is critical.
Yeah. One last question, and then we'll move on. Is the description of the whole intervention available somewhere?
It is. If, on that last slide of mine, you can access the MIRIC website. There's a 19 MIRIC website where and you ought to be able to find a copy of it right there, or contact me and I will be sure you get one.
Yep. And just a reminder, the slides are available on the SPRC website, so you can get that URL or contact Dr. Alexander. Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Next, I'm going to introduce Denise Foster. Since joining Oregon Health and Science University as Emergency Department Director in 2009, our next speaker, Denise Foster, has been a champion for at-risk patients. She worked with a consulting psychiatric specialist to develop and improve standards of care for this patient population, with the aim of achieving not only process and performance improvements, but also greater employee and patient satisfaction, and this during a period when the ED has experienced a substantial growth in the number of patients that are seen. Ms. Foster also participates in the Robert Wood Johnson Aligning Forces for Quality ED Throughput, that's a hard word to say, Throughput Project. Ms. Foster?
Yeah, good afternoon, everyone. Thanks for listening in. I would like to talk to you about our journey to reduce the risk of suicide and improve the care of our suicidal patients in the emergency department. First of all, thanks to Dr. Currier and Dr. Alexander. You've provided a lot of great background information that will help my presentation move along pretty quickly here. First of all, I want to share some information about our emergency department and our local area. We're a level one teaching facility in the Northwest, and we're located near the city center. And according to the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, our area has the highest proportion of homelessness in the nation. And annually, our department sees 43,000 patients, and of those, 10% present with a psychiatric or behavioral chief complaint. And as Dr. Currier alluded to, that's just probably the tip of the iceberg here. Fear of harm to self or others often is what prompts these patients to come to the emergency department. And these patients either present voluntarily or they're brought in by emergency medical services or even law enforcement. Our emergency department, as well as those across the nation and even the world, have experienced an increase in the numbers of patients with psychiatric complaints. And our main objective, of course, is preventing harm to self and to others. And according to the National Institute of Mental Health, suicide is the 10th leading cause of death in the U.S. and definitely a major preventable health concern. Managing the care of these patients requires a multidisciplinary approach. Not only is it important to have knowledge and skilled caregivers, it's also imperative that we set up structures for success. And one of our key structures is designing a model of care that meets the needs of the patients and takes into consideration the department. Our department's journey began when I started my first week here as emergency department director, and I was approached by one of my nurses who expressed his desire to see us provide better care for these patients. His concern sparked my interest, and we were also getting feedback at the time from our patients and our colleagues in the hospital saying that we could do a better job at providing a safe and therapeutic environment. I'm not able to move my slides for some reason.
Stand by.
Yeah, sorry.
We'll get Tiffany to advance.
I'll keep talking, though.
Can you click once on the
screen?
I've tried. No?
Yeah, tried.
With your mouse?
Yep.
Okay.
Done that too.
Tiffany, perhaps you could advance them.
So, Stephanie, I'm on slide 3. Thank you.
I want to give it one more try.
There we go. Sorry. Okay, so early on in our assessment, we identified that the emergency department was experiencing increased volumes of patients who were coming to the hospital with psychiatric needs. And over a 2-year period, the numbers had increased by 20%. This increase reflects the decreasing community and primary psychiatric care resources and is not unique to our facility, as pointed out by our previous presenters. And the majority of these patients were in the emergency department because they exhibited concerns about self-harm, had an actual suicide attempt, or had expressed violence or actually towards others. Can we go to the next slide, please?
Yeah, Tiffany, for some reason it's not working.
I'm just not able to advance.
If you could
advancing
for her, that would be great.
There you go. Thank you. So our reality is that we have decreasing community resources and decreasing inpatient psychiatric beds. And as reviewed earlier by Dr. Currier, these provide a definite increase demands on the emergency department by increasing the length of stay for these patients. And demands for caring these patients in the emergency department are significant. The long lengths are often associated with these patients and are not special to this, and we're not special to this, as 86% of patients report that they sometimes or are often unable to transfer psychiatric patients to inpatient beds. While emergency department caregivers are eager to provide quality care to these patients, until recently, very little has been done to prepare them for meeting the challenges of this population. Next slide, please. So identifying a need, knowing what forces were driving our improvement helped us identify our gaps and areas for focus. And we definitely had the desire to provide quality care and a need to feel good about the care we gave. We also identified some opportunities for improving the working relationship among caregivers and meeting our own professional practice standards. Other forces such as regulatory, patient satisfaction data, community reputation, and our internal customers provided motivation and support for making the change. Next slide, please. Okay. So our priorities. Well, when providing care to suicidal patients, we must consider the balance between safety and patient rights. Dr. Currier mentioned the negative experiences our patients say they have in the emergency department. And anecdotally, this feedback seems very valid. And one of the concerns that is because caregivers are so concerned about safety, they feel compelled to restrict patient activities. It's imperative that they understand the patient's condition and risks when implementing restrictions. And consideration for the patient's rights is fundamental, and developing that trusting relationship, which Dr. Alexander referred to, is paramount. Unfortunately, a knowledge deficit can impact our ability to form that relationship. It can also alter our attitudes towards this population. So caregivers are also concerned with their own safety. This fear is real and substantial, as according to the Emergency Nurse Association, between 8 and 13% of emergency department nurses report being victims of physical harm in the workplace. Often the perpetrators are patients. Next slide, please. Okay, so we wanted to make a change. We need to make a change. We knew we were overheads, and we needed some assistance. First, we turned to some of our internal resources. Our leadership in our inpatient psychiatric department has been amazing in supporting us. Our social workers are very well respected for their role in caring for these patients, and our public safety officers provide support in their presence and lend an extra hand when needed to promote safety and prevent harm. Our nurses and physicians provide direct care and know their realities better than anyone, have been instrumental in driving the change as well. External support in the form of educational materials and literature from our professional organizations were helpful, and although we had many resources, we needed to look outside the organization for more support and hired a consultant psychiatric clinical nurse specialist to do an assessment and provide education and support us during a transition in of our model of care. This step was critical for driving the change. Next slide, please. All right, to share the need, we set some goals, both short-term, long-term, identified our threats and opportunities, and assessed our strengths and weaknesses. Next slide, please. Once our consultant had completed his assessment, he developed an education program, and the nurses attended 4-hour classes, focusing on the nursing role and providing care to psychiatric patients, including assessment, medication management, recognizing risks, and early signs of escalation, as well as unclear coordination, the regulations, and documentation standards. The classes were very well received by the nurses, and the ensuing discussions really provide a lot of information in developing our current model of care. Next slide, please. Many of our changes also resulted from feedback during just casual rounding of the department and through our shared governance and process. We have a unit practice council, and that council did develop goals related to the care of psychiatric patients, specifically suicidal patients. And as mentioned before, the alliance between the inpatient psych unit and the ED has been fundamental in improving our processes related to suicide prevention. And assistance also came from internally in our department from our own emergency department nurses who developed references for care guidelines on charting and organized the work area to make it a little bit more functional. Demonstrating not only did we have buy-in, but there was ownership of the process as well. Next slide, please. One of the changes that we made was in our documentation looking at updating our risk assessment for suicide to use the sad person scale, which is a widely used risk assessment tool with a high reliability among caregivers. Like I mentioned before, we did create some reference binders related to documentation standards, very colorful and with examples of the screen prints. We do use an electronic medical record here. And we also revised our chart audit tool so it reflected all the elements we were looking at improving upon for this care. Next slide. All right, one of the major changes was our staffing model, and this has probably had the biggest impact of anything. was really looking at coordinating the care that the nurses gave. In our old model, the nurse would be assigned to a mixture of patient types, medical and psychiatric. And so medical needs were often the focus, and so psychiatric care was prioritized lower on the list. And a lot of this care was delegated to unlicensed staff to basically watch over patients. Well, we didn't really have a very good standardized plan of care, and our social workers, while great in the role, acted as caregivers, but then the nurses kind of abdicated their role a lot in taking care of the patients. With our new model, the nurses are assigned only to the psychiatric group of patients, so the focus is on those particular needs, and the nurses provide the majority of care, so very little is delegated to unlicensed staff. We now have more standardized order sets, and they're implemented more frequently, and the nurse acts as the coordinator of care. All right, next model, or next slide, sorry. Our outcomes have been promising, and one of the outcomes I'd like to focus on was the improvement in our documentation related to patients in seclusion and restraint. Initially, we were pretty low with our compliance, and a lot of that was a knowledge deficit, as well as just the focus on this patient population, and we actually improved up to 88% in the last quarter of last year, and we're still we're holding our gains. We're about 90% right now, so it's very promising with that. Next slide, please. Another outcome that we're especially proud of is the reduction in the use of seclusion, even with the increasing volumes of suicidal and psychiatric patients. We believe this really does reflect that the nurses and caregivers are better at with their assessment skills and are implementing an individualized plan of care versus the lock them up, everyone is a very high risk approach. Next slide, please. All right, and anecdotally, I think this is the part that gives me the best feeling here is that the staff do report that there is improved collaboration among the caregivers and between the other departments, and they tell me on a regular basis they feel that they're able to provide better care for this population. We do note that the overall patient satisfaction scores have improved, which could be a reflection of many items here, and our physicians are now instituting the order sets much earlier in the stay, so we're getting on top of the care in a more timely manner. Next slide, please. Okay. Well, we're pretty proud of our initial success and pleased with so far, but we're not finished. So next steps, we're going to be doing a refinishing project to promote a physical environment that's more healing. Our current physical environment is not really that appealing. We also want to create some tools for diversion activities such as books, puzzles, music, et cetera, and process them to use those. Continuing education for our caregivers is essential. And we're also developing care pathways for our different populations, and this population is one of the high priorities. So for increased collaboration and then continuity of care. Well, thank you, everyone, for listening. I hope that our journey has provided a little bit of information on how just changing the model of care can promote improved outcomes for this population.
Okay. Thank you very much. And we do have some questions that have come in, and I just want to remind, again, people that to use the Q&A function to ask some questions. One is, could you share what's included in your order sets?
Okay, well, there's a lot of order. There's activity, medication management, crisis management, so a PRN type of medications, as well as the ongoing medication. There's some components. So that's a physician order set, and the care pathways also will include nursing care, such as ambulation and environment of care type of things. We also, depending on the patient's risk as it's assessed, as we escalate, the observation from being just a room there, or if the patient really is truly a high flight risk, and whether or not we need to implement higher restrictive processes.
And here's one that probably we could do a whole webinar, if not a whole day's training on. What strategies might you suggest to instill hope for people who have several of these issues seen daily in the questioner's ED, homelessness, substance abuse, gambling, lost job, partner is leaving, no support network, et cetera?
I'll be honest to say that I am not a clinical expert in psychiatric care, but from the clinician's point of view, I think one of the things is helping the direct care providers in the emergency department understand what resources are available for them. To seek, again, social workers, our psychiatric specialists, et cetera, and creating a list of such resources, because a lot of it is the caregivers at the point of care knowing where to turn for help.
Mm-hmm. A case management function, really.
A case management is, yeah, that's a very good another option.
Yeah. Have you published an article on your new model?
You know, I haven't. Nope.
Maybe we could.
That's a good question.
Yeah, it is a good question. What documentation are you demonstrating increased reporting?
I'm sorry. Could someone?
Yeah, I'm not 100% sure I do understand that question. But myself, what documentation are you? I don't understand it.
Well,
so perhaps the person could.
Yeah. Well, from the viewpoint of, we do monitor our seclusion and restraint use. We are looking at compliance with documenting according to regulatory standards, so we do report that. It's part of our continuous quality improvement process here, as well as in the department specific, the nurses are looking at their compliance with this.
Okay.
So I'm not sure if that's reporting. We also... maybe I'm missing something there, so I'd be happy to answer.
Yeah. Well, it's time for us to move on.
Uh-huh.
And I just want to acknowledge that we really will not be able to get to all of your questions during the webinar, but some of them we may be able to help you with at the end of the webinar, and we'll do that. And thank you again, Ms. Foster. Now I'm going to introduce Gary Parker, who is Manager of Research Services for Mercy Health Center, a hospital operated by the Mercy Health System of Oklahoma. Dr. Parker coordinates research projects for Mercy System organizations, ranging from comparisons of nurse attitudes in China and the United States concerning the care of dying patients, to nurse-driven screening, brief intervention referral, and treatment programs in the ED. For the last 7 years, he has led several projects aiming to address suicide prevention in healthcare, some in partnership with the Oklahoma Department of Mental Health and Substance Abuse Services, and targeting school sports physicals, community emergency departments, and primary care clinics. Dr. Parker?
Thank you very much. First off, thank everybody for coming to attend this and staying on. I know it's been a long afternoon, but I appreciate your time. Where I work at is Mercy Health Center. It's part of the Sisters of Mercy. It's located in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. We're a 300-bed magnet hospital. And I'm just going to kind of tell you the story about how we've kind of evolved with suicide prevention within our hospital and kind of how it all started. How it all started was with the story from an ER nurse who basically told me a really horrible story about a 16-year-old who had came in who died of self-inflicted wounds. And you could just see the look in this nurse's face talking about how this child looked like her daughter or one of her daughter's friends, and just how she wanted to be mad at the parents, but she saw the grief that the parents were going through and just everything that encompassed. And then she made a comment to me. She said, "You just would not believe how many suicide attempts and completions we get within our ED." And I started doing some research onto that, and honestly, it changed my work and my life flow. We are not a mental health hospital. We're a primary care hospital. We do have mental health services in our other hospitals located in St. Louis and in Springfield, Missouri. And I wanted to get started with something. And, you know, I'm just the type of person, if I don't know something, I will pick up a telephone and call to get the information that I need. And I contacted our Oklahoma Department of Mental Health Substance Abuse and was very fortunate. I got a very nice person on the other line named Julie Geddes. And we sat and we kind of talked about a project that we wanted to do together and started attending some of the meetings at the Oklahoma Suicide Youth Coalition and started doing some research to try to really get into the crux of the problem of why all these folks were coming into our ED. What I found was a lot of times when an individual is going to make a suicide attempt or a completion, they're typically seen in the ED prior to that or in a community clinic, usually within 4 to 6 weeks of their attempt or completion. What we found from doing our research, and we actually polled several different doctors and nurse practitioners and PAs, and we ask them, how comfortable are you at recognizing the signs and symptoms of suicide within your patient population? And, you know, they were very honest, and we appreciated that with the doctors. And what we found was about 88% of them out of a sample size of 78 said they wouldn't know it if it hit them, that they wouldn't be able to recognize the signs and symptoms. Furthermore, they didn't know what to say to them or where they could send them. So we use that as our foundation for starting our program. Let me click that. So what we did was we provided education because we realized that our doctors, our nurses, our PAs, they weren't comfortable, nor could they recognize these signs and symptoms. So what we did was we developed an educational program focusing in on the signs and symptoms of suicide. And to back up a little bit, when we started this, we tried to do a structured program like QPR or, you know, some of the other programs that are out there. And what we found was our physicians and nurses just didn't have the time to do that training. They wanted to get the training, but they just didn't have the time to spend a day or 2 days doing like the assist or something like that. So they told us they wanted us to develop a program they could do, and they wanted us to be able to do it within 30 minutes just to focus on the meat of the substance. And what we did was we met with the Oklahoma Department of Mental Health, myself, Julie Geddes, and Jessica Hawkins. We met and we developed a program where we focused in on those signs and symptoms of what they were going to see, you know, how to interact with these patients and how to set up a referral system. We visited, once we put it together, we took it out on the road and we tried it out. We visited a lot of our urban facilities, a lot of our rural facilities, and we really worked on increasing suicide awareness. We provided our education every 2 weeks, and to this day, we still do this as well. We provide our education every 2 weeks in all of our hospitals to all incoming nurses, to our physicians, and to our CNAs or nursing assistants. So basically, we did this all the way across the board. We visited the other hospitals and met with the other educators there to teach them how to provide these classes to the other groups that they're going to interact with. Plus, we created a referral sheet. Something I found interesting is when we started, we had a big book of facilities listed in our state of Oklahoma, but when we went through and we called those places to make sure they were still open, we found many of them were closed, because what we wanted to do was we create a referral sheet so when a doctor in a busy ED picked up the phone, he could ask for an individual by name, so to be able to kind of cut through some of the red tape and, you know, kind of be a priority to get a patient through. So we actually took the time, called these facilities, told them what we were doing, and wanted to get them to basically partner with us on that. For our screening, we sought input from providers across the ministry. Our needs in Oklahoma City are very different than the needs they have, say, in Aurora or Cassville, Missouri, or Lebanon, Missouri. It's all very different. So we actually brought everybody to the table doing basically a lot of conference calls, a lot of different meetings where we ask them, what are you seeing in regards to the suicidal patient? What are you seeing? What's your numbers? What are they coming through? And what we found was each one of our hospitals all had different tools and they all had different policies and procedures. And what our goal was to find a tool we could all use that was evidence-based, that would work, and then for that to reflect that within our policies and our procedures. So as we started doing that, we found that almost all the tools, they weren't evidence-based tools. They were just tools somebody, you know, with good intentions developed and threw out there. So we really worked together, found the evidence-based tools, and we worked those into our system here. We also looked at, once we started doing that for adult, we looked back and we looked at our pediatric population that was coming through, and we found that those tools also were not evidence-based tools. So upon doing another review, pulling another committee together, we were able to find a great screening tool that we were able to use to work within our patient population. We also partnered with, on another project we did, we partnered with Teen Screen out of Columbia, and we were able to actually use them to help us with another project we did where we did a long day of high school screening during a sports physical. We also looked at something we found was the changing level of care. So when a patient comes to the ED and they are not able to go to services within a community, they're too injured or too sick to go to a mental health facility, you know, and they needed to be admitted because they needed nursing care, you know, medical nursing care within the hospital, we went back and we looked at that process, that handoff, how that would happen, because a lot of times within the EDs, they would, you know, giving that handoff to the med-surg nurse or the intensive care nurse, they would say it was an accidental overdose or it was a gunshot wound. You know, we really wanted to work with them and tell them that it was, you know, a suicide attempt, so they would know, and that those suicide precautions could be put into the computer. And that was a process we also worked on, where when suicide precautions would be loaded into the computer as an order, a cascade of events happened. One was an admissions checklist printed out prior to the patient getting to the floor. Security was notified. Security would go to the room prior to the patient being admitted to the med-surg area or intensive care area. They'd remove the needle box. They would make sure they were in a room where the window was bolted shut. They would look at different things in the room. Anything that was possibly they could injure themselves with, we would remove if it was not medically a necessity. We contacted, an email would go out to nutritional services, and the plates would be paper plates. They would have plastic utensils. We'd also arrange a sitter, where we didn't really want to have people in restraints or in seclusion, so we would arrange a sitter. And to make sure that our sitter received training, if they hadn't already had it in their every two-week training we do, or within our yearly skills fair that we also do where we provide training, we would arrange for the sitter to get a just-in-time sheet, and the charge nurse would go over that sheet with the sitter, and they would both go through everything. We also would have it to where the nurse would perform safety checks, where the nurse would actually come in and check the room, or any time they were giving medications, making sure the patient wasn't cheeking those medications, you know, to make sure that, you know, the patient was still doing well. We also have outside psych services. We actually contract our psych services within our hospital here in Oklahoma, and we make sure that we have somebody from one of the local mental health agencies following that patient while they are here, so when they discharge, it's a seamless discharge out. We also notify housekeeping, and we use have a bedside commode brought up as opposed to allowing them in the bathroom, because what we have seen in some other hospitals are people who are on suicide precautions being admitted up to the floor where they actually injure themselves within the bathroom. And some of the future directions we're doing is we're always looking to improve. In fact, I'm working with a group here at Mercy where we're actually working on telepsych. One of the big problems we've had in some of our rural EDs is having patients come through and not being able to get any mental health services due to their locations, or patients sitting for days waiting for that. We're in the process of hooking up 15 of our rural hospitals through telepsych process, where we'll be able to have a mental health professional on the other end of that screen being able to perform that assessment, so we can, you know, decrease our length of stay, which will help that patient and match them into the services they need. We're going to be doing the high school assessment again, and we're working on a couple programs with some schools. We're always looking to improve this, because I really think when you look at the whole thing that Mercy is most proud of is looking for those patients who can't advocate for themselves. And I really feel right now the suicidal patient, the patients that are coming through, are probably the most misunderstood and least advocated for within our system. Publications, we did write an article about what we have done within our community, some of the work we did in the ED as well in the clinics. And we're also working on our second publication, which I've been typing on today, as a matter of fact, to get it sent out. And it's for mental health checkups, screening for teens within the community. And that is it. Any questions? I'm pretty fast, aren't I? I'm an ADHD guy. So.
I'm marveling that we got four presenters in under time.
There you go.
We have actually quite a bit of time left for questions, and there are quite a few in the hopper. So thank you. Thank you very much, Dr. Parker.
Thank you very much.
First of all, let me just say that we were getting a number of questions associated with each of the speakers related to whether materials are available or what screening tools they used, et cetera. And we will actually be sending all webinar participants an email with a link to the online evaluation of the webinar. And one of the questions there asks, would you like to receive updates and announcements about new or upcoming SPRC products or training? And if you answer yes to that question, that allows us to contact you again in the future with things like resource lists or with a link to some online resources that we may be able to post for you. So I would urge you to answer yes to that question so we can keep you informed. Starting with a couple of questions for Dr. Parker. Let's see. What evidence-based risk screening or assessment tool did you decide to use in the ED?
We actually looked at a couple different ones. I tell you, the one I'm most excited about now is a tool that was developed up at Harvard by Lisa Horowitz, and she works in the Department of Psychiatry there, and her article was in Pediatrics, May 2001 edition, and it's one of the tools that she uses there. And basically, they went through and they answered about, there was a number of 14 different items that they had listed, different questions. And for our PEDS population, we really wanted to condense it down to where we're asking no more than 4 to 5 questions. And what we did was, within her paper, it's the predictive ability for combinations looking at these 4 different items. We focused in on questions 1, 5, 8, and 13. And the reason we chose those, it was most pertinent to our population. Plus, the sensitivity, the reliability was really high for those questions. And what those questions were is, are you here because you tried to hurt yourself? In the past week, have you been having thoughts about killing yourself? Have you ever tried to hurt yourself in the past year or any other time? And also, has something very stressful happened to you within the past few weeks? And that allowed us, again, you know, in the busy EDs and with a lot of the nurses and doctors there, what we really found is they just don't have the time to go through and use something like a PHQ-9, which is one of the tools we do use. But in our pediatric population, that way, we wanted to use something a little quicker. We have used the PHQ-9, and I really enjoy that tool quite a bit. So those are the two I like the most right now.
Great.
And there's a lot out there, too. I can tell you, when we did our literature review, we came across quite a few.
Okay, great. Thank you. If we could open the mics of the other panelists at this point. And in fact, one of the questions, this may address perhaps Dr. Alexander's presentation or a couple of the subsequent presentations. One question, do you think that the safety plan or the intervention suggested could be started in the 911 service, the ambulance, on the way to the ED?
Interesting. Is my mic on?
Yes.
Oh, okay. I think that's a really interesting question. I hadn't thought of it, but I suppose it could, as long, you know, the key piece in this safety plan is that it's a collaborative endeavor between the patient and a clinician. So I think anything when the person's in a crisis, to get them to start thinking about what their options really are in terms of managing the crisis in bits and pieces on their own, would probably be a good thing. But interesting question.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I thought so. For either of the first two speakers, regarding the low proportion of suicidal ED patients who follow through with more than a week of outpatient treatment, is there any information on what proportion are struggling alone versus the crisis has abated?
In data that we didn't present here, we have done quite a bit of work with using mobile crisis services to actually meet with patients in the community to get them to link to care. And it's very tricky. In spite of fairly intensive resources allocated to that goal, we haven't been uniformly successful in doing it. Or we're often able to get people to link into care, but to stay for the long haul is often quite difficult, too. So we don't have the magic answer to that question yet, but we're working on it.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Alexander, did you have a comment on that one?
Only just, you know, just an observation of what good success we've had with these safety plans and with the Safe Vet Project, and just that weekly telephone monitoring, which can take 10 minutes or less. We've really been very successful in getting people to show up for not only their first scheduled appointment, but subsequent appointments. So there is something about just regular care with somebody that they know and feel like they have a relationship with that's making a difference.
Mm-hmm. Another question, what special strategies should be employed with persons experiencing cognitive impairment, especially those with mild MR or borderline intellectual functioning or initial presentations of dementia? This appears to be an issue when they live alone and cognitive impairment does not prevent them from living independently, but there's a question about the reliability of their cognitive impairment. Anyone?
Oh.
Well, we exclude people who we don't think can understand, first of all, the nature of the safety plan, and then second of all, research.
On the studies.
Because it's just on ethical grounds. But I think that the safety plan can be geared in language that is either relatively simple or relatively complex, depending on who you're working with.
Yeah.
But for that population, especially in the community, it may be less the safety plan and more the follow-up that is the key to success. So we've had acute services coordinators following up with people in the community. And to my knowledge, that is, in most places, completely absent. So once people leave the ED, they are gone, and who knows what happens to them.
Mm-hmm.
So this second aspect of it has been very exciting.
Mm-hmm. You know, another piece to that is our acute service coordinator in Portland, Amy Coughlin, who may be listening in, did a safety plan with someone who had cognitive impairment, and she ended up putting pictures on the safety plan that they could relate to. So you have to be a little creative, but that worked extremely well with her patient.
Here's a question for the panel also. Our county is working with our EDs to improve our education and data collection of the number of ED visits related to suicide. What data would you recommend we use, ICD-10 codes or something else? Less is more.
There are codes called E-codes that specifically categorize self-injurious behavior, either intentional or unintentional. So, you know, that's something that isn't often added because it doesn't necessarily add to the billing power of the encounter. But there is a strategy for capturing all of this embedded within the ICD system, so you might want to look at that since you already have it. It sounds like you already have it being collected, at least partially.
Can Ms. Foster describe environmental enhancements that she and her team implemented to meet the safety needs for the BH population?
Right now, we're currently in the process where we're moving forward with that. We're sort of limited, and our physical layout is not the best in the world. There are certainly better models, but to overcome that, that's what we focused on, the model of care, where we had a nurse assigned. So we have a nurse's station right at where our psychiatric rooms are, where we put the majority of our psychiatric patients, especially those at high risk for suicide or harm to others. And so that one factor has made a big difference. And so from there, the nurse has a video of the rooms as well as a computer to document that and the resources that he or she would need to document with. Couple of things that we're looking forward to is creating a more therapeutic environment through new flooring and paint and just kind of making it a little bit nicer place. We do know that the environment can really impact the patient's overall mood as well as, you know, their anxiety level.
Great. And then perhaps just this one final question and then we'll move to wrap it up. Is there any evidence to suggest what makes a patient follow up with outpatient care?
Can I?
Yes.
Yeah, two things, short waiting list and give them meds. That's it. That's all we know. If you give them some meds, they follow up to get the prescription. If you don't make people wait, you know, outrageous lengths of time, they tend to come back more. And unfortunately, given the paucity of scarcity of mental health services, waiting lists can be 6, 8, 10 weeks,
yeah,
which is not going to work.
Yeah.
Hey, and something, if I may, I'd like to add.
Mm-hmm.
I think everybody should take the time and read the article that Dr. Currier worked on with Judith Serrell. I quote that article every 2 weeks. It talks about the experiences, and he touched on it, of the patients who come through who made a suicide attempt and their experiences within the ED, because I think a lot of times people just kind of roll their eyes at these patients, and if you read that paper, it's very eye-opening. I didn't realize that Dr. Krieger, the same one on this call, and it was I quote that paper every 2 weeks when we do our education about treating these folks with, you know, compassion and respect, just as you would
Great.
Any other person who comes through the ED.
Great. Yeah. Thank you so much.
That's Julie Serrell, C-E-R-E-L.
Julie Serrell.
She's awesome. perspective.
Great. It's a great paper. When I read it, I'm telling you, it really just brought it all home to me.
Yeah. And as I said a few moments ago, we'll put together, if that's not already on a resource list, we'll put it on a resource list and see what other information we can provide to those of you who did participate in the webinar today, whom I would like to thank for doing so, and thank our panelists very much. This was a really rich, rich amount of information. I also want to thank Tiffany Kim and Zan Young of the Training Institute, and also Lisa Kaposha from the SPRC staff, who's worked behind the scenes to work with the panelists to gather information and to help feed questions to me today. Thank you, Lisa. And so if just a reminder, the webinar slides are available on the SPRC website, and I just want to thank everybody and the webinar here. Unless there's anything further from Zan or Tiffany, we'll say goodbye to everyone.
Thank you, everyone.
Okay.
Have a good day.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Thank you. Bye-bye.